You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 27th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, we have some breaking news. Republicans are morons. That's it. That's the breaking news. Ladies and gentlemen, as I am sure you are aware by now, President Obama supposedly released a supposed long-form birth certificate supposedly at the White House today, and then got on a supposed airplane and supposedly flew in the air to some supposed destination. I am holding in my hand, we have a new position on the Sammy Cam. You can see it now. I am holding it up. The supposed long-form birth certificate. And I say supposed because I am looking at this. I'm holding it in my hand. First of all, I want to point out a couple of things. It says the word Kenya on it. Huh. Wonder why that might be. Wonder why it says right here under birthplace, Kenya, East Africa. I wonder why it says that. Right underneath where it says full name of father. And then the father's name and then birthplace. Okay. All right. Though it strikes me as a little bit odd that, am I wrong about this, guys? Is this not printer paper?
That looks like the kind we use.
This looks identical, virtually identical to the printer paper that we used. Ladies and gentlemen, today on the program, we will be talking to kerning experts from across the country. We have lined up 38 kerning experts at some of the top kerning universities in the country to answer such questions as, did Hawaii have a type number 4 ribbon typewriter back in 1961? I don't know for sure. But one of our kerning experts will answer that question for us. Did Honolulu always spell Hawaii with two I's, even in the early 60s? And why does it say I have a Roman numeral 2 after Obama's last name? Interesting. I never hear him refer to himself as Barack Jr. It's just strange. There's just so many unanswered questions with this. But one of them is not, is Donald Trump a douchebag? Did we find Donald Trump touting his thing?
I couldn't find it.
You couldn't find it?
I'll keep looking.
It wasn't on Raw Story?
I didn't see it.
All right. Forget about it. Don't worry about it, Evan. So Donald Trump was out there today saying, I'm proud of myself for being able to force Obama to release the birth certificate. You know, personally, people are going to go back and forth on this, and when we take we'll take calls after our guest at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can Skype us at Majority Live. I'm not sure I think the timing is the best because you have John Bonaire backing up so hard. I think it's the way we refer to him is John beep 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 no Bonaire, something to that effect. Because this dude is backing off a bunch of things today, and part of it is because of what's happening at these town hall meetings, and part of it is just because he's a moron. But we will talk more about that in the program. But I actually think this is pretty hilarious. And yes, we are now subjected to 24/7 news coverage of how Obama released his birth certificate. And some people say it gives legitimacy to Trump. I can tell you something. Short of Sarah Palin, there is nobody in the country that Barack Obama would rather run against, well, maybe Bernie Madoff, than Donald Trump. And the longer that Donald Trump can maintain this pretense that he is running for the Republican nomination, in fact, after this, he may actually have to. He's the only Republican who's done anything for Republicans. Remember, 47% believe that Barack Obama is not a U.S. citizen. 47%. There's only 30% who believe he's a citizen. There's like another 20% that are not sure. We're not sure. So, strategically, a hilarious move by Obama. I don't think they released this to get people to stop talking about it. I think it's good that people are talking about it. I think they do, too. It makes the Republican base look as lunatic fringe as they are. Coming up next, we don't have a kerning expert. I apologize for that. We have David Ansel. He is the author of County, a memoir, I guess, of his time at Cook County Hospital in Chicago. I wonder if he has his birth certificate. I know what my first question is going to be. We will be right back after this with David Ansel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Dr. David Ansel, the author of County, which will be released, I believe, in days. It is a David, how would you describe the book? Is it a memoir of your time at Cook County Hospital?
Yeah, it's Sam, thanks for having me on your show. It's a memoir of my time at County Hospital. It's really a story about one, a coming of age as a doctor, but secondly, about this storied institution. But the real, both the text and the subtext, is really about how we treat patients in this country who are undesirable either by dint of their insurance status or race. And it's really a story about race, poverty, and healthcare in America. You know, really, and while it reflects back on the past 30 years from the time I was an intern to actually more recent years when they created an independent system board for this health system, and I got appointed to it, it's the 30-year arc and reflection back on, well, what's really changed in that 30 years.
Well, now, I have to admit that I have not yet read the book yet. I'm terribly interested in it, and I've actually sent a request to your publisher via Amazon to get it on a digital form. But let's take me through some of this, because there's a couple of things that I really want to hear about this notion of what happens to the poor in this country in terms of our in terms of their health care, in terms of their ability to get access and treatment. But first, just give me a sense of what Cook County Hospital is like and what it was like when you got there in the late 70s.
Well, it was opening a door and walking back 100 years in healthcare. When I got there in the late 70s, really up until 2002, the building was the oldest public hospital in the United States. There was a huge fight whether it should stay open or not and be replaced. And so we were at once thrown into this, almost medieval sort of circumstances, opened wards, really dirty place, poorly staffed, patients without towels and soap, and being thrown in and learning how to be doctors, but at the same time having to go to protests and organize to keep the hospital open. And we would have debates, is it enough to save Cook County Hospital, or do we really need to transform it? And so that was like then, and the real, I was a young white physician from upstate New York who had really never been in a big city, and suddenly the issue of race and health and poverty in America was really shoved right in your face. And I would say 30 years later in a new facility, the issues are exactly the same. The fact that there's a segment of our population growing that does not have equal access to health care, which should be a right by dint of their humanity, and that the lack of that access, I'm not saying you can't get emergency care, but for chronic diseases that are actually going to kill most of us, and in the need for prevention, early detection, or treatment of these diseases, that's still a barrier 30 years ago, and it's contributing to premature mortality, even in a new facility.
Now we hear so many times. I think I can't remember which senator it was. Just this past weekend, I think it was on there saying that everybody has access to free care. But the fact of the matter is, if you have diabetes, if you don't have an acute situation, if you have something like diabetes, or if you have something like asthma, short of having an asthma attack or something, you're not going to get treatment at an emergency.
I wanted to say this is one of the observations in my book, in County, was the fact is that for most of the diseases that that are afflicting Americans now, that you need not only primary care but access to specialty care for many of them. If you have heart disease, you need to see a cardiologist. If you need cancer, you need to see an oncologist. If you have diabetes, oftentimes an endocrinologist. Chicago has a huge disparity in black-white mortality. In fact, in Chicago, 3,200 black people die each year just because they don't have the same health outcomes as white people. And in certain neighborhoods in Chicago, a young black man between the ages of 16 and 65, 16 years old, has a 50% chance of making it to 65. And then for white young men in America, that's an 80% chance. So there's huge disparities. And when you look, why is that occurring? Yeah, there's some neighborhood issues and there's some behavior issues, but a lot of it is around access to health care. And the public systems like county contribute in a perverse way to this, because the private systems have totally backed out of delivering care. And there are these huge gaps that do require access to primary care and specialty care. It's not, you can't go to an emergency room and get the kind of care that people really need. that's going to prolong life.
Now, is one of the things the Affordable Care Act is supposedly going to do in 2014, if it still exists by that time, is to extend care to somewhere between 15, 20 million. The numbers vary depending on who you're talking about. People who haven't had access to basically health insurance in the past, basically extending Medicaid. From your perspective, is this a solution, a partial solution?
Well, it a little bit reminds me of the two old guys at the Casco Resort. One turns to the other and says, "The food here is terrible," and the other one says, "Yeah, and the portions are too small."
Right.
And I think the problem with the Health Care Act is that it's too little, and it's going to preserve inequality in our system, and it's going to for years to come. So let me explain why. It turns out that having an insurance card is a great liberator because you can get up and go anywhere. But a big part of this act is going to expand Medicaid. One, it puts a huge burden on the states to do this. But also, not everyone accepts Medicaid, and people on Medicaid have trouble accessing both primary care and specialty care. We happen to know that, for example, even under Medicare, where both, say, black people and white people get the same card, there's disparities. But there's even more disparities when we layer in poor different payers. So what we've created is a layered system of health care. I call it apartheid, where the people at the top with the best policies, black or white, can get the best care. But as you break down these policies, they become more restrictive, either because the doctors won't accept it or the hospitals won't accept it, or for other reasons, you know, we end up with disparate outcomes. And so I think, unfortunately, I think it's good that we're expanding more people, but it's not the way I would have gone. I'm a firm believer in single-payer health care, you know, everybody in, nobody out, same kind of coverage for everybody, because it's a great equalizer. We know that for lack of insurance in this country, 45,000 people die each year. The number for racial disparities, black-white difference, is closer to 80,000. That 80,000 black people die every year in the United States just because they don't have equal quality of care as equal outcomes as white people. And a lot of it is driven by inequality in quality. And some of that
so
is
wait a
driven
second. Let
by
me see if
insurance.
I can unpack what you've just said there. We know that 45,000 people a year die because they don't have access to health care. And you're saying that another 80,000 African Americans die because they don't have access to appropriate quality?
So African Americans have, you know, in year 1990 in the United States, our national health goal was to reduce health disparities by 2000. In year 2000, the goal was to eliminate health disparities by 2010, because for the health of the nation, our nation's health experts realized that the only way we're going to make the country healthier was to improve the health of minorities. So while we know that there's a gap for people who don't have insurance, there is actually a larger gap for people that by race and ethnicity. So the majority population, despite a lot of bad habits, and we're not raving about, you know, the health of white people here necessarily, because it could be better, but it turns out both for African Americans and Latinos that there are disparities driven mostly, we think, by the quality of care, driven partially by what insurance card you have.
That's fascinating. So it's actually worse. There's actually a greater gap amongst those, despite the fact that they supposedly have access to care, because the quality of the care is not that good.
It's very interesting. You take Medicare, which should be the great equalizer, single payer, and certainly it is. But it turns out that a black woman who has Medicare is less likely to get recommended to get a mammogram and a pap smear by her doctor. And when you look
than a white woman who has Medicare?
Yes, and let's institutionalized racism is not, you know, necessarily I'm a racist, but what happens is it turns out that 80% of black Medicare recipients in this country are taken care of by 20% of the doctors who tend to be less likely to be board certified, more likely to work in places where they report having difficulty accessing things like mammography and specialty care. And so that's the way, the insidious way that institutionalized racism works in healthcare. When you begin to require that people actually provide the same level of quality, the racial gaps disappear. And so we, you know, so one is having a level playing field where everybody gets the same kind of insurance card. That's why I like single payer. You can pick it up and you can go anywhere. And then by focusing on the quality of care, we think we can reduce or eliminate these disparities. And it's not that hard, but we don't have a, we need to have a national will to do that.
In your
and that's what my book's about, is really about that discovery through my patients, through my own experiences, and through the hospital itself, which is still struggling in Chicago, despite all the king's horses and all the king's men trying to keep the public sector together.
Now, do you have a sense in terms of what has been driving, I don't know if this is something that you focus on, but what has been driving costs up? I mean, I know part of it, of course, is that when we have people who come into a hospital, or when we have people when Medicare is not able to cover the procedures it should, those costs get tacked on to everyone's health care. But what do you have a sense of what other things are maybe driving?
Yeah, you know, I think it's not simple or straightforward, but I'll just say just a couple things. At the highest level in this country, we've created a healthcare system with different payers with different rules, but in some ways we've say it's demand driven. So as long as there's demand for it, we'll try to provide it. The problem is it's demand driven, but has to leave out 46 million people, and still is the most expensive health system in the world. With that, other health systems in the world say, here's our budget for health. How do we provide the best care within the sort of a global budget? So we've organized it at the macroeconomic level in a really crazy way that's guaranteed to drive up costs of the system. So that's one part of it. And then there is this cost shifting that does occur. So, you know, our social compact in a way in the United States is, you know what, there are a lot of people without insurance. So we're going to now cost shift onto everybody. So our health insurance costs more if you have a private system because we're paying for the fact that Medicaid and Medicare and the uninsured have to be paid for. And there's that sort of there's a social cost that's tacked on that makes it more expensive. And plus, I'm going to add greed. You know, there's a huge amount of greed in the system, in the sense that the the more you do, the more money you make.
Right.
And it's just organized that way, and it's not organized around the health of the community. So, you know, we have five academic medical centers in Chicago, and yet if you measure health by healthcare in the community, we have the worst health, among the worst health outcomes in the country. And so, you know, you can have a great stroke program, you know, that gets you in, gets the great technology, but if you're not altering stroke mortality in the community, how good are you? And that's the public health infrastructure, which is really the core for health. And we've underfunded that because you can't make money off of it. And we've overdone sort of the high-tech, you know, low-return
Well, that is part of the dilemma, isn't it? Is that people use the metric of Saudi princes come here to get their health care, so we must have the best health care in the world, as opposed to the metric of how is the population as a whole doing?
Right. We can deliver great health care and even enviable health care. On the other hand, we do it at the expense of a lot of people that die, because they just don't, they can't even get the front door. The most basic kinds of things, both from a public health and a primary care perspective, and it disproportionately falls on the poor and the minorities in this country. And that's kind of what I learned. I mean, that's why I wanted to write the book. I mean, I wanted to started think about this book maybe 25 years ago when I was a resident. And it's only been able to come out now because I had time to write it. But it's really amazing to me, going in 30 years with the idea of going into an institution. We're going to change the world here. We really, if we just got the right people together, if we just, you know, said instead of going to your shiny academic medical center, we're going to go to County Hospital in Chicago and make a stand. And guess what? Having the right people is not enough. This system is designed to give us exactly the outcomes and the results we're getting. And it's, you know, in many ways, it's one chapter in the book that's called I Call It Murder. It was a BBC documentary in the 1970s where one of our doctors was asked, she's now president of the American Public Health Association, Dr. Linda Ray Murray, what do you call what's happening to these patients? You know, being sent from other hospitals and not being taken care of. And she says, I call it murder.
Well,
and so I'm not, what I'm saying is the system is designed to give these results, that new shiny public hospitals are good but not enough. Bringing the right people to work in these institutions is great, but we've got to do something bigger in this country, and I'm afraid our health care bill will fall short because inequity is designed into our system.
The book is called County. It will be released soon. You can pre-order it on Amazon. And we will have a link at majority.fm after the show today.
And I have a website as well, and it's called countythebook.com. And people can look on there. There's a lot of pictures and some text as well that describes the problem that we've just discussed.
Dr. David Ansel, countythebook.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, got to take a break. We'll be back. Plenty more stories to discuss with you. It turns out Atlas really did shrug. Really, really did shrug. And Barack Obama, huge, just sort of a stunning audio clip of in regard to Private Bradley Manning. More when we come back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. We're back. We don't have sound on the Sammy Cam at the moment, folks, but we will deal with that later. Later today at 2:15, I believe, in just two short hours from now or so, Ben Bernanke will hold what appears to be the first press conference ever by a Federal Reserve chairman, a sitting Federal Reserve chairman. We'll provide some coverage for that tomorrow. I mean, the real question is, and David Leonhardt, well, people are going to want to know about QE2, whether or not the quantitative easing is going to stop. He will probably announce that it will. This is the Fed's buying up $600 billion worth of treasuries, basically loaning the government money, more or less, and maintaining the value of treasuries. David Stockman believes that when the Fed stops this, the entire world will stop spinning on its axis and everything will come tumbling down. I think he's wrong. But I guess we will find out soon enough. But David Leonhardt in the New York Times makes a very good point. One question more than any other is crying out for an answer. Why has Mr. Bernanke decided to stop to accept widespread unemployment for years on end, even though he believes he has the power to reduce it? I mean, this is theoretically the goal of the Fed, the primary goal of the Fed. It is to provide jobs. That's the way we define, theoretically, should be defining the health of the economy. And the Fed's own forecasts suggest that unemployment rate won't fall below 5% for perhaps another 5 or 6 years. Bernanke believes the Fed, quote, retains considerable power to reduce unemployment faster, despite the fact that its benchmark interest rate is zero, as he said before, yet he's hesitant to use that power. Now, the fear of the use of that power is that it will overheat the economy and create rampant inflation. However, that has been a warning cry for literally 2 or 3 years straight, and we have seen no increase in inflation. It could announce, according to Leonhardt, that it would keep its benchmark rate at zero for a few years, which would probably hold down long-term rates. That would help employment. It could say that it was comfortable with higher inflation for a limited period of time, given how low inflation has been since 2007 and how high unemployment is. Above all, Bernanke could make clear that he considers years of widespread unemployment to be unacceptable. Instead, that he said more aggressive action brings risks. Low interest rates have the potential to spark inflation by enticing millions of households and businesses to borrow money and causing the economy to overheat. Higher inflation could, among other things, increase borrowing rates for the United States government and worsen the deficit. But in terms of inflation fears, Leonhardt spells it out. It's something that we've talked about on this program. Real inflation, core inflation, is extremely low. And the reason why core inflation does not include energy and food prices is because those tend to jump around based upon droughts, based upon wars in Libya, based upon speculation. It's tough to get a consistent trend. Core inflation has risen at an annual pace of only 2% over the last 3 months, and only a few other occasions over the last 40 years has it been so low. So hopefully somebody will ask him why you won't do anything about unemployment. Because apparently 8, 9% unemployment, which I think that number is actually lower than, higher than the reality of it, is the new normal. Meanwhile, let's go to this Manning thing. You know, I hadn't heard this clip before, and I was interviewing Rick Perlstein for Ring of Fire yesterday, and I think he brought it up. The idea that a sitting president would talk about the guilt or innocence of any individual or not is stunning, and the media would have never allowed a president to do this 30 years ago. It's almost unconscionable. And yet, Barack Obama last week, but the video has since come out, I guess yesterday or the day before. He was at a fundraiser in San Francisco, Obama, and some guy, Logan Price, I don't know who he is, a supporter of Manning, supposedly, got close enough to the president to shake his hand and then raise the issue. Obama, I guess to his credit, engaged him. Now, the audio is rough, folks. We'll post the YouTube on our site. The audio is rough, but you got to listen carefully what Obama's talking about. At one point, he says the guy's guilty. This is a man who has been held in prison for over a year. and has not been tried. This is aside from the fact that he's been tortured, at least according to psychiatrists, made to strip naked, sleep in a burlap bag, kept in a room for 23 hours a day, not allowed to exercise, not allowed to talk, not allowed to read. And, well, let's hear this audio from Obama.
You're in the military. And I have to abide by your deep class fighting. But I'm not authorized to read them. I'm breaking the law. We're a nation of laws. We don't individually make our own decisions about how the laws are. Right? No, he's so fine. He's so fine. I mean, he's getting for this and he's asking a question. No, he broke the law.
You can make it harder to break the law.
What he did was he's done. No, it wasn't the same thing. What it was, Elford wasn't classified the same way. So, anyway, all right.
Okay, the things to hear there, and you hear Obama clearly say he broke the law. He also then says, he addresses, no, he didn't do the same thing that Ellsberg did. It wasn't the same type of top secret information, which is actually not true. I mean, it's very similar to what Ellsberg did. The only thing that saved Ellsberg was that Mike Gravel basically read all the Pentagon papers on the floor of the Senate and then made it public knowledge. He put it into the Senate record, made it public knowledge, and basically short-circuited the prosecution of Ellsberg, although he was persecuted in many ways. But here you have Obama talk about, look, he was part of the military. He has certain things. I have certain restrictions on what I can do. And then he says quite clearly, he broke the law. And if you want to go back, you can watch the YouTube. We'll have it on majority.fm. You can see, hear it a little bit clearer. It's obviously at a fundraiser. There's a lot of sound there. But this is a stunning thing for a president to say for a guy who's not been convicted yet. And it gives you also a sense of just how he's been advised about Manning. And it very well may be that Manning did break the law, but he hasn't been convicted yet. And it's almost as if Obama's been told by his advisors, military, whoever it is he asked, look, he broke the law, and then just said, okay, whatever. And what's really shocking to me about this is he's a constitutional lawyer. It's stunning. And Jim Mizalski, the chief Pentagon correspondent at NBC News, did a piece on this and spent the whole time. I mean, it's a good piece. He writes, the Uniform Code of Military Justice prohibits command influence, in which a superior officer up the chain of command says or does something that could influence any decisions by a military judge or a jury in a criminal case. Barack Obama is the commander-in-chief, so he is at the top of this command influence. A military legal expert says the president himself crossed a legal line with that statement. Eugene Fidel, president of the National Institute of Military Justice, told NBC News that the president's remark is unlawful command influence, which includes an assumption of guilt. President shouldn't have said it. He should have been more circumspect. The White House spokesman Tommy Vietor claimed the president was speaking only generally about the unlawful release of classified material, which is a joke. He said he broke the law. Vietor insisted Obama, quote, was not expressing a view as to the guilt or innocence of PFC Manning specifically. In other words, he was using the more general he that doesn't exist in grammar. But in the end, Fidel, the president of the National Institute of Military Justice, predicts the issue should not adversely affect the prosecution's case against Manning. While a defense lawyer could claim the president's statement unlawfully prejudices the case against the client, potential jurors could be screened to ensure they're not aware of the remark. First of all, there shouldn't be a single person in the country who's not aware of that remark. It should be on the media 24/7. But what's more relevant, aside from the fact that he may have tainted a jury, which he clearly has, you think there's nobody in the military who's going to find out about that? It's absurd. Aside from that, people should be questioning him as to where he got this information that he broke the law. How do you know he broke the law? No one can know that he broke the law. It's impossible because he hasn't been convicted of anything. It's stunning. It really is stunning. And I'm going to assure you of something. This will be the last you hear of it. Perhaps not from me. I don't know what other podcasts or you listen to. Maybe Rachel will talk about it tonight. With all due respect, I watched Lawrence O'Donnell last night, and I saw about a half an hour's worth of Donald Trump, Glenn Beck, and an extensive breakdown of the 2012 Republican race. Are you kidding me? Jesus. Why don't we have a breakdown of who's going to win the Super Bowl in 2013, too? Seriously. It's completely irrelevant at this point. Talk about a mention and make a laugh out of it. Are you really breaking down what Tim Pawlenty's favorability ratings are? Give me a break. Meanwhile, the Vermont Senate, and this is apropos for our conversation with David Ansel today. Someone's going to remind me when I'm going over time. The Vermont Senate passed a bill establishing a single-payer health care system in the state. Last month, the House of Representatives voted 92-49 to advance a bill that would create a single-payer system in the state. Now the Vermont Senate has followed suit. Next up, a conference committee where they make the bills match. Then you will see Governor Peter Shumlin, Democrat, sign this bill. The biggest hurdles that Vermont has is getting a waiver from the Federal Health Care Reform Act, which should be doable, and then finding a legal way around the federal ERISA laws, which protects pensions and employee benefit plans. They violate ERISA, private insurers could sue the state, so they need to figure out a way of getting an amendment that would both provide a waiver from the Health Care Act, which I think is doable, and one fix for ERISA. But this is looking like it could very well happen, folks. Tell me something. If you lived in upstate New York, why would you not move to Vermont to get a single-payer health care? All right, folks, join me on the flip side. Majority FM is the IM. You can call me at 646-257-3920, or Majority Live on your Skype. We'll be right back.